This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The 2016 presidential race is looking a lot like the race for Michigan governor nearly 20 years back.
Seeing outrageous, insulting things, attacking in a very, very personal and almost unprecedented way for a major party candidate.
He's been called Michigan's Trump. But first, there's a category in which Michigan beats countries such as China, Russia, Thailand, Cuba, and Iran. Michigan imprisons its citizens at a higher rate, by far. And Michigan is actually below the national average. Other states such as Louisiana, Georgia, Texas, and Mississippi imprison as many as one out of every 100 residents. A new book is coming out soon. Its title is Caught: The Prison State and the Lockdown of American Politics. The author is Marie Gottschalk, who joins us on Stateside. So what is behind the high rates of incarceration in the U.S.?
There's no one simple answer, but it's more a political answer than a crime and punishment answer. I served on the National Academy of Sciences Committee on the causes of high rates of incarceration, and one thing that we agreed on is that it wasn't criminal behavior primarily that caused these higher rates of incarceration.
In fact, crime rates have dropped, but incarceration rates still remain really high.
Right. So we need to understand it as a political project. There was a spike in crime from the early 60s to early 70s, and that created a kind of shockwave at a moment when there was a lot of political unrest around issues of civil rights in the United States. And some politicians capitalized on that unrest and used crime in a kind of racially coded way to attack the gains of the civil rights movement and to create a backlash against that. And that was at a moment when the Democratic Party was splitting over civil rights issues, and this was a moment when the Republican Party could make strong inroads in the states by emphasizing law and order issues, and the Democrats went catch up on that in exploiting the crime issue for political gain, which was also exploiting racial issues and racial divisions for political gain.
Right. There's a real racial disparity in prisons. African Americans are imprisoned at much higher rates. This has been studied often. There's a lot of evidence of racial bias in arrests and sentencing. What does your research show?
So the racial disparities are not so much in sentencing, but it's a little bit of disparity all along the way. So that, in fact, by the time you get to sentencing, who the person is who's even standing before the judge is in part determined by racial disparity. So you may be a little more likely to be picked up by the cops, more likely to be charged by prosecutors, more likely a little bit to get higher charges or more charges leveled against you, less likely to get an alternative to incarceration offered to you. So this little bit of prejudice that goes along the way. I think one of the things we don't understand about racial disparities is that some of the states that have the highest racial disparities may not have the most racial injustice or social injustice, meaning that states in the South actually have lower rates of disparity, but they have much higher incarceration rates for African Americans. So they're kind of more equal opportunity incarcerators. So they incarcerate lots and lots of blacks, but they also incarcerate lots of whites. So their racial disparities are lower, but the actual number of people who are going to prison are much higher. So a state like Minnesota has much higher racial disparities, but uses prison much more judiciously. So in fact, fewer African Americans, a smaller proportion of African Americans, as well as whites, are serving in prison. So we need to be very careful when we measure everything just by racial disparities and not by the proportion of people who are actually in prison.
Increasingly, we're seeing prisons or aspects of prisons being privatized. In Michigan, it's been the food services for the prisons. Someone is making profit on imprisonment, and I'm wondering what effect that has had on the rate of incarceration.
Right. So it's hard to say that the economic incentive is what got us here, and it's a very popular argument on the left to say it was the prison industrial complex that cause this ratcheting up. All of my studies say that's not what happened. But now that we have so many people incarcerated, economic interests are sustaining mass incarceration. So we have to be careful what caused it and then what sustains it today, and they may not be the same. And it's not just private prisons, but as you say, it's subcontracting out for food services, for health services, for all different kinds of programming. And people have strong vested interests now in the financial gains to be made by incarcerating people. Or, I should say, even more importantly, what we call the prison beyond the prison, which is privatizing bail, privatizing parole, privatizing prioritizing probation. So a number of the prison companies now talk in their annual reports about investing in the corrections life cycle, expecting that people would be in prison, they'll come out on home arrest, they'll come out on electronic monitoring, and the private sector is maneuvering itself to be well invested in those new growth areas.
It seems like there's an opportunity for some real problems when you start doing that. We recently saw a Pennsylvania judge who was sentenced to 28 years in prison for a scheme called Kids for Cash. Basically, there were kickbacks to the judge when he sentenced juveniles to incarceration. What's that say about incentives and influence on the justice system?
One of the things in American history is that we have an ignominious history of the private sector, particularly in the 19th century and early 20th century, being heavily involved in incarceration. And we had the awful convict leasing system in the South that many people called worse than slavery. And one of the big advances in government policy and public policy was to get the private sector out of criminal justice, and that there's an idea that certain services should be done by the government and should be highly regulated by the government and overseen by the government. And we're seeing an erosion of that principle now. Private prisons don't save more money. The conditions tend to be worse in private facilities than in public facilities. We have pushes for privatizations at moments when we're very anti-government, so we'll have lots of privatization, but also less oversight by the government of the private sector. The private sector is not susceptible to Freedom of Information Acts, so it's even harder to find out information about the conditions of confinement because they don't easily fall into, you know, some basic government regulations that we have. So it's leaving people who are in prison and jail already vulnerable, even more vulnerable, often in private sector facilities.
What's the takeaway from your book? What do you want us to understand?
What I want to understand, well, the subtitle of the book is The Prison State and the Lockdown of American Politics, and that we can't just, the first part of that is that we can't just talk about the 2.2 million people who are in prison and jail, or even the 5 million people who are somehow being watched in probation, parole, but rather that we have now a carceral state that's metastasized into our very institutions, and that none of us is 6 degrees of separation anymore from the criminal justice system because we have so many people who are disenfranchised. It affects our electoral outcomes. Our demographic databases are corrupted on poverty, unemployment, health, because we don't count this large incarcerated population. And I think more fundamentally, there's a question for all of us. What does it mean to be the self-proclaimed world's leading democracy and also be the world's warden? And I think the second takeaway is also in the subtitle, the lockdown of American politics, that if we understand the problems of the carceral state, we can begin to understand why there's this amazing disconnect today between the enormous problems that the United States faces, income inequality, climate change, and the inability of the political system to address those. I don't talk about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in my book, but I think you can read my book and understand why we have the emergence, very surprising emergence, of these two political figures in this moment in political time because of that disconnect between problems and solutions in the political system.
Marie Gottschalk is the author of Caught, The Prison State and the Lockdown of American Politics, published by Princeton University Press. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's the weekend, people. Time for a cocktail with Tammy Coxon from Tammy's Tastings.
Cheers.
Cheers.
What's our drink this weekend?
Well, I've been listening to all these reports from Tracy Samilton from Cuba, and that got me thinking about Cuba's contribution to cocktail culture.
And what would that be?
Well, a lot of our favorite cocktails come from there, but the mojito is probably the best known, and that's what we're going to make. It's one of our favorites.
It's a big summertime drink. So how do you make it?
Well, I took some mint from my front yard, just about one sprig, and I stripped off the leaves and put them into the bottom of my cocktail shaker.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of mint fields in mid-Michigan.
Well, I have a mint field in my front yard, so this is how I weed the mint in my front yard, is I pull out whole plants and make mojitos with them. So we're going to take the mint, and then this is where my mojito is a little different than some other people's, that I cut up a lime into wedges, half of a lime, so four wedges, and I put that into the shaker on top of the mint, and then I muddle that. If you muddle the mint too much, it gets bitter in a mojito. So by muddling it with the lime juice, I'm going to prevent that bitterness from coming out.
Okay, what are the liquids that go into this?
So I'm going to put in 1 ounce of simple syrup and then 2 ounces of white rum. Today we use the Water Hill rum, which is from Ann Arbor's own distilling company, A2 Distilling. That goes in there with some ice, and I give that a good shake. And then I'm going to strain it off into an ice-filled highball glass and add just enough club soda to fill it up to the top.
And you add a little mint sprig just to make it look nice, or is that for a little scent too?
Both things. When you garnish a cocktail with something like mint, it appeals to both your eyes and your nose. You're going to get that strong mint aroma as soon as you take a sip.
Now, I've had really sweet mojitos, and I've had really nice mojitos, which to me are less sweet. What does yours taste like?
It's light, it's not too sweet, and it's really refreshing. Because we muddle the limes, you get a little bit of that oil from the lime peel, and that adds a lot of complexity and really unique flavor to the drink.
Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Cheers.
Up next, want to experience the golden age of radio? Well then, create a radio drama. We meet a team of students doing just that. And then later in the program, when the U.S. economy is humming, we need them. When the economy tanks, we push them out. We'll hear about how we've treated Mexican immigrants and sometimes Mexican-American citizens. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Some say you can mark the day the golden age of radio ended. CBS aired the final episode of the radio drama Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar at 6:35 p.m. on September 30th, 1962.
Drop the gun.
You try throwing that bottle of nitro down.
Yeah, at you.
Set it down now, gently. Set it down.
No, I'm throwing it now.
One English teacher at the University of Michigan says there's a lot to learn from that era. He's teaching his students how that kind of radio was made. Michigan Radio's Mark Rush went to see what this class is all about.
Mike Byers is the guy who teaches this class. He's an author. I read his book, Percival's Planet, and it's a book that takes you back to the 1930s, right into the lives of the people who lived back then. So this radio drama class, a class that studies what radio shows were like from 1930 to 1962, it's kind of a perfect fit for him. Beyer says the radio made back then wasn't just all cop shows, comedies, and sci-fi freakouts. Other shows were produced, too.
And a great show called Destination Freedom.
If you came for trouble, you'll find it. We got enough kicking against the segregation laws without outsiders adding to it.
A great address of all kinds of long-standing racial inequities in this country addressed in this very straightforward, matter-of-fact way, in a way that we don't really have anymore. You don't hear that.
Byers says this English class is also a secret history course. And it's a history and an art form that he's passing on to his students. It's the week before graduation, and right now, Byers' class is preparing for its final test. These students all wrote original radio dramas, and they voted on 3 of them to perform in front of a live audience. Right now, they're getting ready for tonight's performance. Byers says he's taught this course before.
And this is the third time we've done it. Every time is a little different. And this time the shows, I think, are pretty solid. Well, let me put it this way.
There aren't any radio engineers here. We're talking English 346.
Well, I usually teach books.
But they manage. The live show starts in a few hours, and right now they're testing a series of gadgets they'll use for their sound effects. Byers shows me that thing that all radio dramas need, a door.
And then I turned it sideways because it was falling apart. And now it's not falling apart anymore. And as you can hear...
Ooh, that has a nice sound.
Isn't that good?
And let's say that door leads you outside. Student Eric Zugabe has that covered.
So this is a wind machine, and you turn it like this, and it mimics the sound of the wind.
Okay, they've got doors and wind. How about the sound for that doll that can put a curse on people? Well, for that, senior Sean Danaher scored a homemade theremin from the physics department.
Anytime we have the curse doll appearing in a scene and characters getting close to her and the curse basically working, we have this effect going on.
The students in this room are also running through their lines. Sarah Sisk is a junior in English. She came up with the cursed doll idea for her show McQuinn and McQuinn Soup Detectives.
So they're detectives who investigate curses and hauntings and other paranormal activities like a regular detective would.
She's also performing in two of the other dramas. Sisk is playing the part of an evil German woman in an episode of The Adventures of Tintin.
I actually have the script right here. Let's
okay, yes.
It. Okay, so Tintin's getting away, basically. Good gravy. Look, it's Tintin. He's out of the hospital and getting on this train with us.
There it is.
It's purple.
It's not that bad. Sis says she has a tendency to let a French accent bleed into her German one. Senior Randy Lockett is busy highlighting his script. He wants to be sure he hits his cues.
Well, in two of the episodes, I'm playing the shoes, the footsteps.
Randy, you've got the biggest role.
Byers jokes that Lockett is basically the star of one of the dramas. There are a lot of running scenes. A couple of hours later, and we're in an auditorium. It's showtime. The students and their gadgets are all up on stage as Byers introduces his class. The students will perform all three dramas, all right in a row.
We're not going to stop, no matter what happens. What you see here is something that's as close to the original conditions as we could get, given our own constraints.
The show starts, and the actors approach the microphone, holding their scripts. They don't always get close to the microphone, but close enough, I suppose. Sarah Sisk does well.
Good gravy. Look, it's Tintin. He's out of the hospital and getting on this train with us.
And whose fault is that?
And Randy Lockett pulls off his big part. The students put on about an hour and a half of live radio. Sure, there were some pregnant pauses and a few miscues, but when the students worked their way off stage, they were all smiles and hugs and high fives. It's not the typical ending for a college-level English class. For Stateside, I'm Mark Rush.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. As you no doubt know, the presidential campaigns have been talking about immigration in the country, everything from reform that would be a roadmap to citizenship to building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. We've had immigration arguments for a long time, about as long as the U.S. has been a country, and these debates always escalate when the U.S. economy takes a downturn. In fact, when there are labor shortages, we turn to Mexico. We encourage immigration. The moment the economy tanks, we want to send those workers packing back to Mexico, and this country has actually pushed Mexican immigrants out of the country, even when some were actually U.S. citizens. Here to discuss some of this history are Maria Cotera, an associate professor at the University of Michigan, and Elena Harada, a community activist and whose family was sent from Detroit to Mexico and has documented that almost forgotten part of history. So, Elena, let's start with your family's history briefly. When did they come to Detroit, and how and why were they pushed out?
Well, my family came to Detroit in 1920, recruited by Ford, like many others. My grandfather actually served in the war. And he was he worked on the railroad, and he was in New York.
So he's in World War One.
He was in World War One,
and there was a labor shortage because all the doughboys were overseas.
Yes, he actually had served in the war, which became an important point later. So my family was repatriated during the Depression, along with about maybe 15,000 other Mexicans from Detroit, about a million across the country. And there's a lot of debate about those numbers, and no one can say for sure what those numbers were, because most people did not sign in when they came back, and there were many people who were just put on trains and in caravans and sent away.
When you say were sent back, was this the government forcing them onto trains? Was this business interest saying, you've got to go, we don't have enough jobs for anybody else? How did that and who did that?
Well, it was actually the Department of Labor that carried out the beginning of it. There wasn't really, it wasn't immigration. It wasn't an act of Congress. There were hearings in Congress, but there was never an actual official act. And it was actually done by political pressure and policy. And it was done very lawlessly.
And some of these people of Mexican heritage were actually U.S. citizens.
60% of them were U.S. born. My father and all of his siblings were born in the U.S. In fact, my grandparents took their children. My grandparents were Mexican nationals. They took their children to Mexico to stay with the grandmother. Their children were born in Detroit. They were U.S. citizens. My grandparents, who were Mexican nationals, returned and worked. So they were sending money home to their U.S.-born children. And my grandfather could work on the WPA because he had served in the war.
But later, when those children wanted to come to the U.S., what happened?
Well, they came back in 2 years. And it's been very, very hard to get people to talk about this in our history. It's very hard for people to talk about the Mexican repatriation in the Mexican communities across the country. This was very true for Detroit, but it also turned out to be true everywhere else. And Detroit sort of broke the story on it. Detroit was one of the heavily impacted cities because every place where there was heavy recruitment for industry, there was a lot of Mexicans that came to those places and worked and then were turned back when the economy was taking a dive. So places like Detroit, Chicago, Lafayette, Indiana, all over the Midwest where there was heavy industry, there was Mexican communities. They were recruited to come. They were invited to work. Sound familiar? So they were recruited to come, and then when there was this very nativist sort of culture took hold, very much like what Trump is doing now, by turning people against anyone who may have come for an opportunity. So they were sent back, but some places reported that they were held at gunpoint and forced into paddy wagons and trucks. Others simply got a knock on the door from the welfare department and were told that they had to leave. There was a variety of ways.
Maria, it seems this repatriation has become a cyclical thing. What does the research show? Because this happened in the late 19th century. It happened post-World War I and while the Depression was on, and it happened again in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what is at stake with the sort of recruitment, the cyclical recruitment and repatriation of labor is controlling and creating flexible labor pools that are essentially at your beck and call, right, or at the state's beck and call, who's working in the interest of industry. And we see different kinds of sort of labor that are repatriated or deported. In the 50s with Operation Wetback, you really saw a focus on agricultural labor, right? Because the Bracero program, which was a binational agreement between the U.S. and Mexico to bring in agricultural labor during the Second World War, when those laborers were perceived as no longer needed, you had the enactment of Operation Wetback, which was a policy to deport many of the people who had left the Bracero program and settled out in agricultural communities.
Now, we just heard a reference to Donald Trump. Are we seeing this same kind of thing? I mean, this is a nation of immigrants. The anti-immigration movement today seems to be focused on Hispanic, Latino immigrants mm-hmm. and refugees from the Middle East. Is this more about race than about immigration?
Well, I mean, I just want to point one thing out is that even before Trump, over the last decade, we've seen a focus on primarily Mexican and Latino labor and calls to repatriate or deport laborers here in the United States from Latin America and Mexico. And you saw this actually in the last election cycle mm-hmm. when Mitt Romney and others were advocating for what was called at that time self-deportation. This is, in fact, the context in which Elena and I partnered up and decided to work on acquainting a broader community with this history, because we saw a lot of resonances in what ICE was doing on the streets of Detroit and all through southeastern Michigan, and what the calls for self-deportation were sounding like. So I do think that it's important to remember that even though Latinos are considered by the census, right, as an ethnicity and not a race, they are racialized subjects in our country. And so they become really easily targeted communities when pressures around economic depression start to hit.
Now, Elena, you decided that this point in history, or these points in history, needed to be brought to life. You went out on an oral history project to find these stories. Tell me a little bit about that.
This is a lifelong journey. I was fortunate to be a student in Chicano Boricua Studies at Wayne State University in the 70s. And had I not been in a class of people who were in every way my counterparts, we were the Mexicans that didn't speak Spanish. We were the Mexicans that didn't really have very many, but this is overall for the majority of us, didn't really have close ties to Mexico, but were Chicanos, Mexicans from the U.S. And we learned from our professor, and I will call the name of Dennis Valdez, who told us about this repatriation that had happened. And I was reading about it in my books, and I asked my grandfather about it. I would just rush to him to say, look, this is what happened. No, that didn't happen. And I talked to my father about it, and they said that didn't happen. They basically just denied that there was this deportation. And they were—
Even though they were part of it.
They were part of it, yeah. And maybe because they weren't sent with guns. They weren't like held at gunpoint and deported or carried off by immigration officers, but they were forced out because there wasn't any money for them. There was no way for them to feed their families, and people were literally starving. People were literally losing children to very, very basic childhood diseases. And these were stories that people just didn't want to talk about. But I want to say that we've spent, 30-some years chronicling the history of Mexicans. My work has been mostly in Detroit, but it's also across the state. And then we've gathered with wonderful forces across the country because every Mexican family, of course, like every other family, has their keepers of the history. And they will say, yeah, you know, I wondered why we never saw this person again or that person again or what happened to this branch of the family or why they don't talk about this. And we would begin to be able to pull together the story and put our history back together.
Well, the reason they don't want to talk about it, is it a matter of embarrassment that they were shipped out of the U.S.?
I'll quote my dad because he's not here to argue with me. My dad really hated this project. He really hated it. He died in 2010. And he was, I think, 2 years old when they left and about 4 years old when they returned from Mexico. So he was separated from his parents during that time along with his other siblings. I didn't want for Mexican people, our elders, to say, you know, like we wanted any special treatment. I just wanted to say we need to take our place in the history of building Detroit. We need to say we were here. We built the cars. We built the railroads. We did everything else along with everybody else who was here because we were really absent in the history books of that period of time.
So what are the lessons that we can learn after seeing Mexican immigrants forced out of Detroit before, after helping to establish the success of the city, and today's immigration and possibly leaving the city? Is there any lesson?
Well, I mean, I think that understanding the cyclical nature of the whole question of the immigrant threat is really, really essential, first of all, so that we can be clear-headed about what is actually going on, which is that there are interests that need labor, and those interests don't need labor all the time. And so if our government policy is going to be, vis-a-vis immigrants, is going to be sort of controlled by those business interests, then we need a much more clear-headed response by activists, by scholars, by social service agencies to deal with the fact that there are people in this country who we've brought into this country who have laid down stakes in this country that we also owe something to. And they're not disposable people. They can't just be gotten rid of when we no longer, quote unquote, need them. I think there are larger historical lessons we can learn, and I think Elena can speak to those and the importance of recovering this history.
Elena, we'll give you the last word.
I think that it's really important to know that not a border, not a policy, not a politician can stop the human impulse for a family, for a person reaching their dreams, and for creating something better for their children than they had for themselves. All of us are products of that impulse. Nothing is going to stop that. And I have great faith in the possibilities, and it doesn't matter what anybody does about immigration policy, because I think the world over, all immigrants trying to travel to anywhere they're trying to get to survive have got to prevail.
That's Elena Harada. She's a community activist in Detroit. And we also heard from Maria Katera, an associate professor in the Literature, Science, and Arts Department at the University of Michigan. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up later, finding someone to marry has changed over the decades.
The old adage was opposites attracted. And the reason why people would say opposites attract is because you wanted to marry somebody who was going to be a complement to your set of skills.
Now, we look for people like us. Internet dating services are looking for people like us. That's in just a few minutes. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Last month, the New York Times published a piece entitled Equality in Marriages Grows and So Does Class Divide. It reveals whom we choose to marry generally has changed over the decades, and now more often it's a marriage of equals rather than a breadwinner marrying a homemaker. The article cites a study, Marriage and Divorce, Changes and Their Driving Forces. Betsy Stevenson is a co-author of that paper and an economist at the University of Michigan. So let's start with some basics. How, among opposite-sex couples, has choosing a partner for marriage changed over the 20th and early 21st centuries?
Well, it used to be that the old adage was opposites attracted. And the reason why people would say opposites attract is because you wanted to marry somebody who was going to be a complement to your set of skills. So if you're really good in the labor market, you're going to be able to bring home a good income. You want someone who's going to be able to run the household while you're at work. That's sort of the classic family that we all, you know, remember from the 50s, is you found people who were marrying who did separate things, and they specialized in their separate activities. What's happened is technological change combined with growth in the market economy and combined with new opportunities for women have all meant that that type of marriage isn't a marriage that's thriving anymore. What type of marriage that's thriving are marriages where people have similar skills and they're not trying to bring separate things to the table, but in fact, the benefit they're getting from marriage is from being similar to each other. And that type of watching the same TV shows, liking the same movies, having similar ideas about how to raise children together jointly, it's a very different type of marriage than a world in which, you know, moms did something very different than dads.
Well, let's talk about some of the economic impacts of that. I mean, the results end up something like this. The wealthier, better educated people choose each other. Less wealthy, less educated people choose each other. The wealthier couple ends up moving to a neighborhood where there are other wealthy couples like them. The less wealthy couple can't afford to live in those kinds of places, so they end up living among people who are more like them. We end up with this kind of organic class segregation. How has that changed America? And does that really hold up as a rule?
One of the most compelling facts that helps you understand what's happening is the fact that college-educated women used to be the least likely women to get married. And the reason was they had a lot of skills that they could use outside of the home, they could use in the marketplace, but the traditional marriage where they were supposed to specialize in the home wasn't as appealing to them. So you saw very low marriage rates for college-educated women, extremely low marriage rates for women with graduate degrees. And today, those are exactly the women who are the most likely to get married.
Do we know why?
It's because marriage has changed in a way that means that it's now appealing for college-educated women, because when they marry, they're not committing to being a specialist homemaker, providing, making clothes, making meals from scratch, running the household, but they're instead coming together as equals with someone where they're both going to contribute by earning money that they can use to buy the types of things that women used to make. You know, my mom used to make clothes. We don't make clothes anymore because there's such a thick market and there's an opportunity for us to buy clothes at much lower prices than we used to be able to buy them at. And as a result, and we have much better opportunities of things to do with our time. So we don't want a great seamstress at home who's concentrating in making the clothes, cooking meals from scratch. Instead, women can come into marriages and contribute through earning a market income and being equal. And that's made marriage very appealing for college-educated women who are looking for companionship, not to have specialized roles.
So we get to that point where you've got this double income, both of them making better than average income, and I want to get to that class segregation part of it because that's what we're talking about. You started out saying we used to have a marriage of opposites, but now we're looking more like a marriage of equals, but that does contribute to this class segregation problem.
When we look at household income, you see dual earner households where you have college graduate marries college graduate compared to dual earner households where high school only marries high school only, you're going to see a bigger gap than we used to see. But in some sense, we want to keep in mind that women have always contributed to what their households were able to consume and the quality of life in their households. They used to do it through home production. And we didn't measure the quality and the extent to which they were able to make pies and make dinner and make clothes. So it's, you know, that in some sense,
or the contribution to the economic well-being of the family.
Right. Yeah. So in some sense, now we're measuring it all in dollars. It looks like it's really grown a lot. Some of that is a little bit of a measurement issue, but some of it's real because by letting women go into the market, women are able to do the thing that is going to make them most productive. And as a result, you have very, you know, highly skilled women who are going out to the market, who are earning a lot of money, who are marrying men who can earn a lot of money. And you have them, as you said, you know, marrying together, living in neighborhoods with other people who are like them and parenting in a different way than lower skilled, less educated couples and forming households in a different way. This is contributing to these differences. But I wouldn't say it's all driven necessarily by the fact that we're seeing these changing marriage patterns.
Although women are doing much better as far as economic equality than they have in the past, there's still this pay inequality between women and men. How does being married affect that pay gap?
What we do see is that women still get very large penalties for taking time out of the labor force. And even time out that I personally don't think of as time out, like a maternity leave is not, in my opinion, a time out. But when we see women taking a 3-month maternity leave in a lot of careers, they can take a pretty big pay hit for that. So the maternity leave itself may be paid, but then you look at the types of promotions they get in the ensuing years. So we know there's a motherhood penalty in the data. We know that there are penalties from taking time out of the labor force or time out of work. Some of that contributes to the pay gap. We still see sort of a traditional situation where when women are married with kids, they face bigger earnings gaps than when they're not.
Increasingly, women are making more money than their male partners. How has that changed the dynamics of marriage?
Well, there was actually a really interesting study that showed there's a lot of households where income is quite equal, and women avoid situations where they earn just a little bit more than their husbands. It's not worth it to them to get a little bit more when it's going to mean that they earn more than their husband. If they're going to get a lot more, sure, they'll confront the awkwardness in the family. But if it's just a little bit more, they might as well stay on the side of earning a little bit less. So there is still a tension in relationships where when the woman starts to earn more, people feel uncomfortable about it. And so that study that showed that people try to avoid being in that situation pointed out that that's still an issue, that we still need to embrace the idea that it doesn't matter who earns more.
A growing number of couples just opt out of the idea of marriage altogether. From an economic perspective, what's the impact of that decision?
First of all, I would say economists always talk about marriage when they really mean coupledom. You can actually separate these things. You know, what does it mean to be legally married? What does it mean to form a household with someone? If you're thinking about forming a household with a long-term commitment, you know, there are obviously a lot of benefits to doing that. Again, if you're picking somebody who has the same interests as you, you buy one TV and you watch TV together and it's more fun than if you two are living in separate households. So you're then buying two TVs. So there's shared what economists would call public goods. We typically think of public goods as the playground, but the public good is also your house within the confines of your household. So the more you can share those goods with another person, the more of them you'll get to have. There's real benefits from forming that relationship. And so when couples aren't forming it, they're losing out. But it's also important to know that in today's marriages, where the gains aren't coming from specialization, they're coming from sharing those kind of public goods together, then marriage is most beneficial for people who have the time and resources to enjoy those kind of goods. If you are struggling to make ends meet, you might find that a relationship is more trouble than it's worth. And that's, in fact, one of the things we're seeing among lower income households, that women are able to support themselves, so they're able to go out and earn a living. And, you know, they find that their relationship, the gains they get from it, aren't offsetting necessarily the costs. And I think it's important for people to realize that we don't want people to get married so that they can be financially stable, but we actually want to help people achieve financial stability so that they can pursue the benefits of a relationship.
You're getting to the point I wanted to follow up on. And we've been talking chiefly about economic considerations about couples and marriage and divorce, but tell me there's more to that than that, please. I mean, there's happiness too, right?
Exactly. Marriage is really about having a better life because you're sharing that life with someone else. And you want to find the right partner to do that with, a person for whom sort of everything is going to be better because you're doing it with that person. You know, in the past, better meant, well, you know, we worked as a team and you did your stuff and I did my stuff and that's why things were better. Today, we get the luxury of being able to do things together. It's not, I'm not relying on you to make up for my weaknesses, because I can go out into the market and buy the things that make up for my weaknesses. Instead, the weaknesses I'm looking for you to help me with are more emotional, psychological weaknesses. I'm looking for you to support me, to encourage me, to help keep me happy. That companionship model of marriage that's thriving, but couples need to have the financial stability in their lives to be able to pursue that kind of happiness.
What kind of economic correlations factor into whether a marriage lasts, whether there's a divorce?
People should realize that the divorce rate peaked in the 1970s, and it's been coming down. Marriages have become more stable in recent generations. A couple things that are contributing to that. Some of it is that people have a better idea of what their life's going to look like. You know, back in the 70s when people got married, they thought, oh, I'm going to be a homemaker, my husband's going to earn a living, and then things changed and the woman got a job and the husband was unhappy with it and the wife was unhappy with the husband's unhappiness and the marriage didn't last. Today, I think people have a pretty good sense of what kind of marriage they want. But the other thing is that people are getting married when they're a little bit older because they are looking for that person who's going to be a companion, and they're waiting until they have a little bit more of a sense of themselves so they know what kind of person is actually going to be well suited to them. And we see that these marriages that start at older ages are much more stable than the ones that start, say, in your early 20s.
Betsy Stevenson is an economist at the University of Michigan and a co-author of the paper Marriage and Divorce, Changes and Their Driving Forces. Thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure. Great talking with you today.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Republicans have one candidate left standing for the party's presidential nomination. As you probably know, Senator Ted Cruz and Governor John Kasich both suspended their campaigns this week, leaving Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee. In a blog post, Zach Gorchow with Gongwer sees some parallels between this year's politics and a past race for Michigan governor. Zach, take us back to 1998. What was it about the race that reminds you of what's happening this year?
Basically had a hostile takeover of one of the major political parties in the nominee for governor. Jeffrey Feiger, the famous attorney, won the Democratic nomination, shocked the Democratic establishment. This was not their choice to be their flag bearer against John Engler, and he did it in a way that was based on his celebrity, and he did it in a way that was based on his absolute antipathy for the presumptive candidate of the other party, John Engler, and saying outrageous, insulting things, attacking in a very, very personal and almost unprecedented way for a major party candidate. In this case, we have Donald Trump doing the same to, you know, major Republican candidates, and Hillary Clinton, the likely candidate for the Democratic Party.
You know, Jeffrey Feiger actually made that same point that you're making, a parallel point, on WJBK Channel 2's Let It Rip, following the Republican debate in Detroit.
I did exactly what Trump is doing to the Democratic Party. And what they did is they rolled up their tents and they walked away.
So it got nasty and personal between Figer and Engler. What did Mr. Figer's candidacy do for the Democratic Party?
It was a disaster. He lost that race by approximately a 61 to 39% vote. At the time, the Democrats had a majority in the House of Representatives. In the election where Jeffrey Figer headed the ballot, they lost 6 seats in the House and thus lost control of the House. It positioned the Republicans to control the House for quite some time and redraw the maps. The Democrats lost control of the Michigan Supreme Court. And for all intents and purposes, they haven't controlled the court since, other than a few months, sort of a fluke situation in 2010. It was a devastating result for the Democrats.
Before the election, you write, the spin for the top Democrats at the time seems hilarious in retrospect. In what way?
Well, the day after Jeffrey Figer won the Democratic primary, and most Democratic establishment types were supporting Larry Owen at the time. Basically, the Democrats felt they had no choice but to hitch their wagon to Figer. They said things like he brought out untraditional voters and that Democrats would come out to vote in big numbers because of the way Figer was going after Engler, that he had developed this new coalition and that it would be transferable and result in a great result in the general election. It just did not work out that way at all.
Yeah, it's a lot like what we're hearing today among leading Michigan Republicans who are lining up behind Donald Trump in the name of party unity, even if they disagree with some of his statements and positions. What does a politician gain or possibly lose in doing that?
Well, you know, the fear, I think, for a politician, whether it's a Democrat talking about Jeffrey Figer in 98 or a Republican in 2016 about Donald Trump, is, you know, the plurality, in some cases the majority of their voters, said they supported this person. So, you know, are you really going to come out and basically say your own voters got it wrong? That could be problematic to do that. On the other hand, by refusing to distance themselves from a very controversial figure who, with a history of ridiculous statements, you know, maybe temporarily risk your own credibility.
At the same time, if Trump is president, these politicians are going to look like geniuses.
Right. I mean, you know, hey, there's always a chance, right? I think personally that Donald Trump's path to the presidency is probably not there, but, you know, I suppose you got to at least say there's a chance. You never know what could happen. And if he somehow were to win, if Jeffrey Figer had somehow won in 1998, like you said, they would have looked prophetic and they would have said, yeah, you know, it's a good thing I didn't infuriate my party's new president, or in that case, governor.
At the end of your piece, you quote a past Democratic operative. Who was that and what did he say?
Oh, well, okay, so this is a good one here. So Ken Brock, who sadly and untimely passed away last year, had been asked by Gallingward News Service at the time about the sort of Figer phenomenon. And basically his point was that this was going to take down the ticket. And his point was, though, that if this is sort of the catharsis the party needed to reorient itself, that it just felt it had to nominate somebody like this to make a point, well, okay. But as he put it, it's a hell of a price to pay for taking down the whole party's ticket.
So do you think the Republicans can learn a lesson from the Democrats' debacle back in 98?
Ooh. You know, I don't know if there's a lesson to be learned so much that they can apply in anything they can do differently. I mean, you know, Donald Trump's their candidate. There's nothing they could do about it. And in 1998, Jeffrey Figer was the Democratic candidate, and there was nothing they could do about that other than to decide whether they were publicly going to support or oppose that candidate and deal with the consequences, whatever they may be. You know, at the time, I think the Republicans said about Jeffrey Figer, well, this is a time for Democrats to show whether they're going to stand up and be counted and say they can support somebody like this for governor. And now you're seeing the same thing with Donald Trump, that given the kind of statements he's made about Hispanics and women and others, you're seeing Democrats now saying this is a time for Republicans to stand and be counted. And you're seeing a number of Republicans saying this is a time for people in our party to stand and be counted. Can we align ourselves with someone like this?
Interesting blog post, Zach. Thanks very much for talking with us about it.
Thank you.
Zach Gorchow is editor with Gallingward News Service. We've been talking about the parallels between the 1998 gubernatorial contest and this year's presidential contest. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Ali Billings, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Ryan Grimes, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.